Welcome. You are listening to The Creative Spark. My name is G. Brian Benson, and I'm an award-winning author, project coach, actor, TEDx speaker, creative, and four-time Ironman triathlete. I love to creatively inspire and be inspired. And with each episode, I will be talking of authors, athletes, entrepreneurs, artists, and actors sharing their journey of success and learning how to find the joy and peace of mind that comes with stepping into one's own skin and going beyond anything they might previously have thought possible. I hope that their stories and strategies provide insight, tools, and empowerment to step up your creative game and help you live your best life. So without further ado, let's get going. If you're a big sports fan like myself, you will definitely recognize this week's guest, Kevin Negandhi. He's everywhere on ESPN. He's an anchor on SportsCenter. He also covers ESPN College Football and ABC. He's hosted Baseball Tonight, College Football Live, and Outside the Lines. He's also been a fill-in anchor on NFL Live and First Take. He's also hosted the Rose Parade, Special Olympic World Games, and USA Games on ESPN and ABC. And to top it all off, Kevin hosted the first ever NBA draft that aired on ABC in 2020. And Kevin is the first anchor of Indian American descent to be on a national sports network in American television history. Welcome, Kevin.
Brian, it's great to be a part of this. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure having you here with me. You know, there's so much I want to talk about, but first of all, I just want to, you know, say in addition to you obviously being very talented and good at what you do, one of the reasons I reached out to you is because you seem like a really kind, down-to-earth person. And to me, that means a lot in today's world. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. I've always said, just be yourself. The reason why you're where you're at is because of relationships and friendships. And that has not changed through the years. I got great advice when I was in college where I thought I had to be like a certain type of person. And a couple of mentors who were, you know, in the business that were anchors, they were just like, just be yourself. Trust me. That's all you could be. And that's the best that it'll shine through. You don't need to kind of fit a certain mold. You don't need to be, you know, a certain type of style. And this is when I was, you know, SportsCenter was in its heyday of personalities, right? And everybody tried to have a catchphrase and try to be somebody. And in your early 20s, you think, oh, I want to be like that person. And then you find out real fast that over time, that'll be exposed. Just be authentic to yourself. That's the most important thing.
I thank you for saying that. I couldn't agree with you more. I kind of fell into that trap early on when I first started writing books and felt like I needed to do it like everybody else. And it's, you'd run into a dead end and you're not really happy doing it that way, you know? And so thank you. That's perfect. When did you know you wanted to get into sports journalism?
I stumbled into it. You know, there were clues along the way, but you know, when I was, you know, 8-9 years old, I wanted to become an architect. I loved drawing. I loved the idea of building something. I have a very creative mind when it comes to like being an artist and how do I draw this and how do I envision this? And so, you know, that was kind of the backstory along with me loving sports, the backstory for me at a young age. And to me, it was pretty easy. It was, you know, by the time I was a young teenager, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be an architect. And my guidance counselor at the time, phenomenal woman, she just told me, she's like, take this one class. It's called Building Construction. It was actually taught by her husband. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll take that. And I remember the first week into that class, I came home and I was like, I never want to do this again. I want nothing to do with architecture. I had no idea that we had to get like this technical and behind the scenes, like you've got to understand what the footer is. And like, I didn't want to do all that. I just wanted to draw. So a couple of months later, at the time I'm 14 in the ninth grade, and a couple of months later, I remember watching a college basketball game. I remember where I was. I remember, you know, the afternoon, and it was a West Coast game, and it was on national TV. And I just remember watching, you know, this basketball player that was at the free throw line, and the play-by-play guy and the color guy were having a conversation as they were going into the background of the player. And they said, he wants our job. He wants to do what we're doing. And at that moment, I've shared this story many times. It was like a light bulb literally went above my head, cartoon style. And I was like, wait a second, you can get paid to do this? You can travel around the world and talk about sports and you can go to all these games. And I remember watching SportsCenter that night and watching, because I was watching every day. I was one of those guys that was consuming the nighttime SportsCenter, wake up the next day, they're doing the re-airs. After, you know, they have those exercise classes and I'm watching the re-air, I know what's going to happen next. I'm watching this like SportsCenter on reruns like multiple times in the morning. And I just, that's where it was in my blood. And then that specific night it hit me. I was like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to become the first Indian American on SportsCenter working at ESPN. Now at 14 in 1989, it's pretty crazy to think that way. But at the same time, I'm glad that I had those type of dreams and I stuck with it because, you know, you could have these false type of dreams, which are phenomenal when you're younger because you mm-hmm. feel like you're immortal, right? And you mm-hmm. feel like I can do anything in the world. And I was really blessed with a system around me where my parents let me believe that. But at the same time, deep down, they were preparing for other things and they were just saying, all right, we'll see how long this goes. And by the time I was 14, I knew what I wanted to do.
That's awesome. So for the most, I wanted to be a Portland Trailblazer, by the way. And that dream ended after my freshman year in basketball, because I had, you know, all that kind of stuff. But were your parents for the most part supportive, or were they still kind of trying to steer you?
Oh, they were always steering me. I come from immigrants. You know, my dad came, you know, I think everybody that has a relatable story of Indian background, because many of us are first generation. My parents came to India. I mean, from India, my dad came in 69. My mom came in 71 with my brother because my dad had to establish things. So they were always the Indian family belief and culture is stability, right? The two most important things are your family and your job. And they work hand in hand. You can't have a family unless you have a stable job. So they looked at it like, all right, he's this, you know, this American kid now who thinks he can do whatever he wants. But in the end, over time, he'll grow out of this. And my dad always wanted me to get into politics. He would always say to me, you're going to be the first Indian American in Congress. I have no doubt about it. And my mom on the other side would, she knew I didn't have the stomach to go in the medical profession while she was there. She always said, you're going to be a lawyer because you could debate with anybody. Your conversations are always involved with me and you always try to win and you know, while you're arguing with me. So she always, I mean, to the point where Brian, 5 years into my job at ESPN, I'm pretty much into the culture of ESPN and I'm kind of rising and I'm doing a lot of shows and still 5 years into my career at ESPN specifically and 15 years in general into broadcasting, my mom still was letting me know that I could always take the LSAT because she looked at it as stability. Like her belief was stability. And they were extremely supportive when it came to picking schools and then me transferring. And then, you know, my first job was not one of those jobs where you're making a lot of money. And I had to basically tell my dad, you know, hey, cause my dad basically said, how much you're making, like 15,000. Tell me what the goal is when you're 30. Like, and I had to explain everything to him and he was like, okay, all right, well, if it doesn't work out by the time you're 30, then what are we going to do? And I was like, okay, if it doesn't work out, then I'll go to business. I'll do something and, you know, maybe get my MBA. And my parents were just, they were understanding and supportive of the whole process.
No, that's awesome. I mean, well, that's all you can really ask for, right? You know, just
totally.
What were some of the jobs, whether it was in high school or when you got into college, that you began to kind of get your chops and develop your skills?
So I didn't really, you know, originally I went to Syracuse because I thought that's where Bob Costas went. That's where Marv Albert went. That's where, you know, Mike Tirico and Dick Stockton. And, you know, it was like, well, I've got to go to Syracuse. And I didn't have a lot of experience. You know, now when you look at high schools, a lot of high schools have, you know, TV programs set up. They're actually a lot more advanced than anything we did it back in college because they have their own, you know, daily shows and people are, you know, because the equipment's easily accessible. It's lighter weight. It's faster. So I didn't have those benefits. You know, when I went to college, I didn't really know what I was going to do in the sense of getting experience. I just said, all right, I've got to go to the radio station. I've got to go figure something out. And couldn't find that, you know, I spent one semester at Syracuse and for me, it was about surviving because the winter would, you know, winter was really bad. And I knew halfway through that first semester, I had to get out of there. Yeah. And I transferred to Temple, which was phenomenal for me because it was in the fourth biggest market at the time in Philadelphia. There were many more opportunities I felt at the school of communications. And so within my first year at Temple, I knew that, all right, I got to plan it out here. I've got to learn how to write first. And if I can learn how to write, then radio will be a little bit easier. And then if I could do radio storytelling, then TV will be easier. So that's kind of how I planned it out, plotted the whole thing. My freshman year, I walked into the newspaper, the Temple News, and they were looking, the new editor there was revamping the whole, department. She was looking for a sports editor and she's like, can you do something? And I was like, yeah. And Brian, I had no idea what I was doing. And suddenly I was in charge of the department. I knew that was a weakness of mine. So I made sure that I was there. If I wasn't in class, I was there till 2 a.m. every day, laying out the paper, you know, with our staff. And we were a daily at the time. And so for 2 years, I would literally write every day. I'd go to stories. I'd cover, you know, the basketball team, which was ranked in the country with John Chaney. I was making sure, you know, I'd go to a Phillies game or an Eagles game or, you know, a Sixers or a Flyers game, just to kind of have my elbows next to the Philadelphia media. That's where I met a young man who was always in a suit all the time while everybody else was, you know, sports writers are a different breed. And this guy was always walking in with a suit on. And I went up to him one day and you know, I'm 20 and I always felt like I any question I ask is not a dumb one because I'm in college.
Right.
So I said to this guy, I said, why are you dressed up in a suit all the time? I just don't understand. Like, and he said to me specifically, Kevin, to be the part, you got to look the part. And that stuck with me. That guy was Stephen A. Smith. And it's amazing how, you know, obviously Stephen A is, you know, one of the faces at ESPN and, you know, him and I go way back. So, I mean, he knew me when I was 20 and wet behind the ears trying to figure things out. And Brian, after I did, you know, a lot of the writing, radio, I just immersed myself at the radio station where I could do women's play-by-play for 3 years where I'm traveling, I'm calling basketball games every 2 or 3 days, you're thinking on your feet constantly for 2 or 3 hours because you're ad-libbing the entire time. You're understanding how a broadcast goes, right? And then that was an easy thing for me to kind of say, all right, well, by my junior year, I got in the college TV station. I felt like I was confident enough in who I could be when it came to deadline writing because of the newspaper side, when it came to storytelling because of the radio side. And then one other thing. So I'm doing all those three things at once. And then I started doing internships and I had figured out a way to, you know, build relationships at all the TV stations where I would meet somebody, then meet somebody. And then from one internship to the next internship. Now you could only do a certain amount of internships for credit. And what I did was I figured out like the system. And the dean of the School of Communications and I had a great relationship. And I just told her, I said, I need experience. This is what I need in this business. And she's like, I see what all the things you're doing. She said, if you want to do another internship, she's like, use that as an independent study. Get only one credit. But the key is that you're getting experience at the TV station every single day with, you know, real like professionals that have been in the business for 20 or 30 years. And I was doing that. I did 5 internships. So I found a way to kind of get my feet into everything. Because Brian, I got to tell you, that it came down to one thing. I worked on fear. Fear was my greatest motivation in college. I worked on this fear of letting myself down, because when you're out of college, you can't go back to an internship. And I didn't want to sit there outside in a hallway about to do an interview for my first job saying the words, "What if?" So I lived off this mantra: do not say "what if," just do it all. Because when you look back and you're out of college, you know you did everything.
Yeah.
And you don't have to answer that "what if." What if I did this? What if I did that? Cover everything. And that's kind of how I lived for those 4.5 years.
Oh, I love how, first of all, that you, I mean, just half a backtrack, you identified all the skills that you needed to have. And even, you know, they were scary for you, but I mean, you still said yes. I'm a true believer like yourself, you know, just say yes and you'll find a way to do it, or you'll learn on the go. And you did that, and you just kept putting yourself, stepping out of your comfort zone, you know, and you know, you did everything you needed to do, as well as just make all the contacts. I mean, that's textbook. And you know, it's not easy, because I mean, when you're, you know, it's scary.
It's very scary, especially when you're writing something and everybody is reading it, you know. and the cool thing for me was I looked at this as a challenge of, okay, I want to eventually be on TV, but let me learn how to write, because if I could write, I could do anything I want in life. And yes. So if this TV thing didn't work, I can get into marketing, I get into PR, I can get into anything, because I know how to effectively write and draw in a reader. And how I would do things, I would go to games, I would see who was on press row at the Philadelphia Daily News, the Philadelphia Inquirer. Sometimes it was Sports Illustrated or USA Today that were covering the events that I was at. Mm-hmm. And I would see, I would write a game story. And then the next day I would read how those writers view the game and compare it to how I view the game. Mm. And then that's how I would pick up points, because every single day it was like a laboratory where I was learning how to write and be effective and communicate in shorter sentences, and then how to hit with certain words. Because I was reading these guys the next day and say, oh, he brought this up. Next time when I go, I've got to see it this way, because that was a really effective way to describe, you know, a 10-0 run when they were down by 15. And maybe I'll do that the next time. And that really helped me every day, being around people who were at the same event. And then they were writing something, I was writing something, then I can compare what worked for them. What did I like from them? What can I take from them that helps me effectively with my voice?
I love it. That's very clever. No, it is.
It was trial by error.
I sense, I mean, I'm a bit of a self-motivated person, and I can tell you are too. And you know, you just, when you want something bad enough, you dive in, right? I mean, you had end goal in mind, sport, ESPN, right? I mean,
yeah. And you know, I by the time I was in college, I had kind of modified my viewpoint on what I wanted to do. Where I was just like, okay. The more you start to realize, okay, there are so many local jobs in the country. I only see 20 to 30 anchors at ESPN. Let's get realistic, because everybody in this room that when I'm taking this class wants to be at ESPN. Mm-hmm. So it was like, okay, let's get some reality here. What I still have my dream, but I also have a certain sense of place and where I'm at and what I need to do to just stay in the business. Mm-hmm. And so I modified my dream by the time I got out of school, and it was like, okay, I want to get to ESPN eventually, but it'll be great if I eventually came back to Philadelphia and I made this my home. Mm. And I actually made that promise to my mom when I first got, you know, my first job. And my first job was in Kirksville, Missouri, you know, out of 220 markets, it was market 198. And, you know, we were like, you know how, like, you know, when Columbus set sail, and they all thought the earth was flat and you were going to fall off. Like we were in a small town and you were going to fall off, but it was the best place for me to go. But one of the things I told my mom before I left, because my mom was like, you know, I see a lot of your cousins are staying in the area because they took jobs in a different profession where they could stay around here. I see a lot of people that you graduated with that are staying around here. And my mom was just like, well, why do you have to go at 23 to, you know, Missouri? And I had to tell her, you know, Mom, I've got to do this every day. I've got to actually make mistakes every day and learn every day. And that's the only way I'm going to be getting better at this, because every day the constant reps are the difference for me in TV. But I as fully, you know, I made this, you know, 14-year-old dream, like, you know, sequence of what I want to do. And then at 23, I made another dream sequence. I told my mom, I said, Mom, by the end of all of this, I'll be in your living room every single day, I promise. You know? And I said, so I may not be with you, but I will be in your living room, I promise. And Brian, to this day, every single show I'm on, I am not kidding, my mom texts me, thank you for visiting me in my living room. Oh, every single, awesome. You know, when I made it to ESPN for the last 15 years, she asks me my schedule during the week. She asks me every day and she double checks. Are you on E1 today? Well, you know, how is it, a 2-hour show? We go through the whole thing. Or are you on ABC today doing college football? When are the half times? Are you, you know, doing something with the Rose Bowl? When are you going to, when can I see you later on? You know, every single time she texts me 10 minutes into a show, she'll say something about what I'm wearing, or if she likes my haircut, she likes my tie, and then she'll say, thanks for visiting me in my living room. And it's one of those things, Brian, you're manifesting it, right? You're unaware that what you're saying is actually going to be true, but you're manifesting it in the universe.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm 100% with you there. That's awesome. That's fantastic. Wow. Just gives me chills. I mean, she must be very proud, and you know, it must make you very happy.
Yes. I think any son, you know, the most important people in your life are your mom and dad. And in my culture, the Indian culture, the only thing that matters is, you know, making sure that your parents socially are proud of you. You know, that was ingrained in me on don't embarrass us. Don't embarrass us, you know, and trying to like live up to their expectations. So when it's time, they can go out and they could say, that's my son. Right. Yeah. And so I live that every day, like, you know, I have satisfaction, you know, but at the same time, I still live by that motto and making sure my parents are proud of what I've done. And, you know, whenever I go back to my hometown of Phoenixville, I hear so many great stories of, you know, if I'll go in somewhere, I'll see somebody that'll be like, oh my goodness, your mom was, I just saw her a couple weeks ago and she won't stop talking. And I tell everybody, I'm like, she's my biggest fan. And I'm really lucky that she's my biggest fan. And she's just super proud of that. And to me, there's just nothing better.
Yeah, that's awesome. So being the first anchor of Indian American descent to be on a national sports network, how did that feel? And were there possibly any doors closed for you when you were starting out because of that?
Yeah. So there were a couple of doors I faced. I remember in high school when I had a different guidance counselor, I went from my junior high guidance counselor who I loved to my high school guidance counselor at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember being a junior, and it came time to looking at schools, and I sat down with the guidance counselor and I told him what I wanted to do. And his first response was, well, you know, Syracuse is really hard to get into, and let's look at other occupations that you can do and other things that we can get you involved in. And I'll never forget, you know, how it felt when I heard him say that. And at 17, when you're hearing that, you know, no matter what you're going to say, that person came in with his own perspective on what they think your limitations are and what they think you should do. I took it as, okay, all right, I'll be respectful in this conversation. And I walked out of there, and it was such a big chip on my shoulder. And I said to myself, I'll never go back to that guy again. I actually found another guidance counselor in that school who I still remain friends with. And she was amazing, like amazing. And she believed in me. And I just said to myself, I'll never go to that. He doesn't know me. And that was my attitude. He doesn't know who I am. He came in with his own kind of prejudices, his own belief system on who I am, and defined me without even trying to explore this. So his opinion doesn't matter, but I will also use that as fuel moving forward. When I got into, you know, college and it was time to put together a tape and you're applying to these markets, you know, in South Dakota, small towns in California and Texas and, you know, throughout the country where, you know, there's not a lot of people that look like me. And at the same time, there was only one local Indian guy, I should say one Indian American that was in local sports in TV history at the time.
Wow.
And that was in San Jose. His name's Raj Mathai, who's now a news anchor there. Mm. And so there were not a lot of people in 1998 that looked like me.
Yeah.
And I remember one of my mentors saying to me, hey, when you get in, Kevin, you're going to go quickly up. He's like, it's just breaking through. That's going to be your toughest part. Mm. And he was right. Like he said, Kevin, you have a look that could actually help you in so many ways. But he also said, we may need to change your name, your last name. And in the beginning, and I was like, oh man. And Brian, you'll love this story. I was like, oh man, what am I going to do? I he's actually telling me that maybe I have to change my last name. Now he used a bunch of examples in the Philadelphia market. There was two or three stars in Philadelphia. And he was like, that's not their last name.
Really?
That guy has a hardcore Polish last name. And that guy has a hardcore German last name. So when he said this to me, I was like, okay, that makes sense. He's like, you've got to be smart about it. And so he wasn't saying it in a way that was offensive. He was saying in a way like, hey, this is the reality of the TV business. Let's be smart about it. Let's take advantage of it. And let's go. So I remember I sat on this for like a week, not knowing what I was going to say to my mom and dad who came to America to make this great life for us and carry our name. And now I've got to say, yeah, I'm going to choose a profession where I'm not going to have your name. Mm. So I didn't know what to do. And a week after that conversation with one of my mentors, my mom, you know, calls me downstairs. And my parents are not one of those meeting type of parents where let's sit down in the living room and let's all talk. They were never like that. They were super casual. They had something to say. They'd just tell me. So I go downstairs. My dad's sitting there. My mom's sitting there. And my mom goes, so your dad and I have been thinking if you're getting into TV, maybe it's time that we look at changing your last name. And I was like, whoa, what are you talking about? Wow. And my mom pulled out this list of names and I was stunned. Like there were all these hard Irish names. And I was like, oh, I'm not Irish. We can't fool people. Kevin's Irish, but the last name can't be that Irish, you know? And what it told me though, is that my parents understood my dream and they were like, we've got to find a way to help him. And it got to the point where I got defensive and I was like, no, you guys, I want to stick with the Gandhi. And they're like, no, let's be smart. So for one semester at Temple, I changed my last name and I got ridiculed by,
what did you
by
change
all
it to?
My friends. I changed it to Kevin Kersey, K-E-R. So just have alliteration.
Like Jerome the dumbest thing in the world.
Yeah, Kevin Kersey, K-E-R-S-E-Y, okay. Right? Yeah. And like Jerome Kersey, yeah. Right, of the Blazers.
Yeah.
And I remember we went on the air at the TV station on the college campus, and my teacher, my professor, who's phenomenal, God bless him, Rick Beardsley, and like three or four of my closest friends who were directors and producers and camera guys, they would not stop killing me like for 3 weeks. And I was like, what am I doing? This is the dumbest thing in the world. Like I can't do this. And I'm actually grateful that, you know, that they told me that they didn't have to tell me, but they gave me the business for it because that's what friends are for. And right. I went back quickly to Nagandhi and it worked out really well. Yeah. And then when I got to ESPN, so, you know, that was another battle. Mm. When I got to ESPN, like there was this fear that I can't screw up if I'm the first Indian American here. Like,
okay.
We get judged. We get judged. And yeah, people are going to paint a broad brush. So I knew I had to work 3, 4, 5 times harder than everybody around me because I was always nervous that if I don't do well here, mm-hmm. it's not going to bode well for other Indian Americans or people that look like me of Pakistani descent, you know, like just, it's not going to, like, I've got to nail this for people who are watching at home getting their first perspective for people that are like aspiring to be at ESPN. So the first few years were nerve-wracking every single night. I put this added pressure on myself that when I was on the air to not screw up.
That's when really you do screw up.
Exactly. That's a great point. I was really proud that, you know, within a few years, Anish Shroff got an opportunity. And now he's a phenomenal play-by-play guy for ESPN. Zubin Mehenti, who's been fantastic the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Adnan Burke, who was a star with us, and now he's at MLB Network and the NHL Network. Like, guys that have followed, you know, after me have done so well because of merit, not because of how they look or, you know, what their name is. It's because they're such good guys in the industry. Adam Amin, who's a star at Fox, used to be at ESPN. Those guys got in, they busted their butt, they made sure. Nabil Kareem's another one. Like, I just mentioned five plus guys who were, you know, who were, I think, guys that came into the business and had the same type of dreams, and then they realized that now they've blazed their own path in so many ways for other people to watch.
Well, that's got to feel good that you kind of helped open the door.
Oh, absolutely. And we're on a text chain, and we support each other. We always share stories when people, you know, mix us up. Darinoka, I love to death. And his mom's American, his dad is Iranian. Like, he was here before me, and him and I, you know, we always say to each other, Dari, my career's in your hands, so don't screw it up, because so many people think he is me and I am him, you know, and we say that vice versa. So I'm glad that I'm associated with all those guys.
Oh, that's awesome. So in the 15 years that you've been there at ESPN, you had a front row seat to, you know, a lot of incredible sports moments, but also, and a lot of characters, but also a lot of change. What do you like about sports these days? And what are some of the things you dislike about sports compared to maybe 15, 20 years ago?
Well, you know, 15, 20 years ago, we didn't have social media. Mm-hmm. And I think that changed literally everything. Shoot, you could make a case that social media has changed society. How we are as a society, right?
For sure.
I think what I've, over the last 15 years, I've loved this space where we're adapting to everything. You know, a lot of it, especially in the coming off, you know, what we've experienced in the pandemic as we're still in it, is that, you know, you felt like you had to be perfect. And now since the pandemic, everybody does, you know, Zooms, everybody's
pivoted.
When you watch TV. Exactly. When you watch TV now, you could do satellite interviews on your phone. You could FaceTime, and suddenly you're doing an interview with a head coach. And it's not like anymore. And like, after that coach just won a game, and it's not like, well, we've got to wait for a cameraman to get there and what's the right lighting. Now people are just being very, very real and organic with the process that I appreciate. You could screw up because everybody understands, like, what you're being is authentic and real. Mm-hmm. You're not being perfect. I've just noticed that when you're trying to be, everything's got to be right. Like you said, it's not going to be right. And people don't want to see something perfect. They want to see something real and something that they can relate to. And that's what I've noticed over the last few years at ESPN. What I love about the dynamic at ESPN too is our adaptability. We think out the box in many ways. You know, like, you have the Madden. I mean, you have the Manning cast last night. You know, that has developed so well over the last year on how to think. Hey, let's watch conventional TV. Let's also have a sideshow where on ESPN2, where we have two legends talking about it with, you know, stars like a LeBron James, The Rock, you know, Tom Brady. And then let's go back and forth while watching this. I just love that type of interaction that we've seen over the years as we continue to kind of evolve and understand what does the viewer like, how does the viewer consume this stuff, how do they process it. Some people like the conventional view, some people like, hey, I just want to freestyle. I like that we've adapted and we're aware of the audience that way. And, you know, we have like, you know, these Twitter shows on digital where you could watch something and you could be at the same sporting event as what our conventional broadcast is. And then you have another crew that is bringing it to you differently. You know, that's the one thing I absolutely love about the evolution over the last 15 years. The one thing I hate about this evolution is the impact of social media literally affecting everything. Like sometimes, and the people that make the loudest noise, whether it's of substance or not, gain the most attention, right? And sometimes the storytelling or the themes of the storytelling remain on people that want to, I think, take over everything you think about instead of, you know, the backstories of people who do behind the scenes phenomenal work, how dedicated they are to making sure they're great at what they do and also impacting people. You know, there's a lot of, hey, who's the me first guy and the me first, you know, athlete? Let's give them the attention instead of, hey, who's the person that deserves the pub and the coverage right now?
Yeah.
And that's not just, you know, that's just that. I think that's just society in general. It's the Kardashian way, right? It's and I think it has affected every single thing we do. And, you know, unfortunately, it's kind of seeped into how we do, you know, how we cover sports.
Well, yeah, you know, and you know, what you mentioned about, though, just the authenticity thing, I think it is really starting to kind of bubble up that people are tired of all that kind of crap and they're wanting more authenticity and it's, you know what I mean? And realness.
Yeah.
And so hopefully that just, that wave keeps coming up and that'll kind of push out some of the noise. I don't know.
Totally.
But, I mean,
I completely agree. And then, you know, in the end, like, for example, this conversation of the podcast, we didn't have podcasts before, you know, And what we're seeing now is I appreciate athletes having more control of how they want to communicate to fans. But what we're seeing too is by having more control and organizations having more control of the narrative, we're seeing less and less stories that are critical because reporters can't get in the locker room. So when I say critical, yeah. I'm not saying criticizing. I'm saying looking at a viewpoint on, hey, what happened here? Instead of now saying,
they're manufactured.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then you lose the idea of covering a story now, right? Now it's more like, hey, this is what I want covered. And that's about it.
Mm. Yeah. You're covering what they want you to cover.
Exactly. And they're controlling the narrative. And let's just use this as an example. Over the weekend, you know, some hard NFL games. Pandemic plays a role here, but you can't go inside a locker room now to find the, you know, storylines and have those side conversations where they're off the record and you get context on what exactly happened on this play, right? Mm-hmm. So somebody in the media can better explain it to you. What I also have seen over the years, you know, especially the last 15 years, is you're also seeing more and more experienced writers and broadcasters looking for jobs, whether it's because of salary or just they're not getting the ability to kind of have a showcase show. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, all right, we're just going to go with, you know, talent that is fairly inexperienced. So they're not, maybe not asking the right questions. And you lose the, you know, 20 to 30 years of people in the industry that understand, wait a second, let's take a closer look. I'm not afraid to ask this question, you know? And I think that hurts the fan, you know, the day after when you're trying to find out what exactly happened to this play that affected the game.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, ESPN's let a lot of people go in the last couple of years because of downsizing and what have you. And a lot of the people were very, very experienced. I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about, correct?
Yeah, but I also think it's not just ESPN. Like if Fox Sports went through all of that, you see the entire newspaper industry, especially in sports departments. You see local TV now, maybe if you're lucky, you have like two people in a sports department, you know, on the air. I grew up where, you know, there were four or five people in a sports department. And when you're losing that on the local level, you know, you're losing the impact of context. So listen, ESPN's a part of it, but I think it's not just one of those, hey, it's just ESPN. It is the entire, I mean, media landscape across the board. We just grab the headlines.
Yeah.
Because okay. Of the four letters, you know?
You're the sports leader. Absolutely.
Exactly.
So this show, obviously, as you know, is kind of all about celebrating creativity and hopefully inspiring others to kind of tap into and share their own creative gifts. And can you give me some examples as an on-air personality and sports journalist, how your creativity comes out in the work you do, and how much does ESPN encourage you to express your personality and creativity in your work, or do they kind of mute it? I know in the past, it was kind of celebrated with like the Kenny Mayne's, et cetera, right? The quirky charm.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you, ESPN has never sent an email out to me or anybody I know that says, hey, you can't do this, in the sense of we want to stop you from creativity. Like there's no, or we need you to talk about this. Mm-hmm. You know, what I've always experienced is just be authentic, be yourself. And that's kind of where I tap into my creativity. I watch a game or I'll do a highlight. And what you're getting is you're getting a fan perspective, aware of how the fan's going to react. But my job is to also give you some information and context on how big of a play this is, or why this play happened, and the effect of what happened from this play and how that plays out. My job is to bring out the best in our analysts and make sure they're most comfortable. And many of those guys like to laugh and have fun while, you know, getting serious about stories. My job is to get to the bottom line of why we're talking about this story. So we have a show meeting every day for SportsCenter, and, you know, it gives us the ability to say, hey, why don't we cover this? And no one's talking about this. How about we ask this type of question? I'm curious about this, you know, as we find out who's going to be on the show. That gives us the ability to be creative. That gives us the ability to say, hey, how about like we bring in this story and we tie it in this time? You know, one of my favorite stories was the week of the Rams Eagles game in 2017. Nick Foles was, you know, a backup, but Carson Wentz was the guy. The season Nick Foles won the Super Bowl, but Carson Wentz was the guy who was the MVP guy. So we did a story where the Eagles are flying out to LA, and I explained it from the Philadelphia perspective. I went all around the entire city and did like these stand-ups in different spots, getting the Philly flavor. I ended it with me ringing the bell at a Sixers game. And on the other side, Neil Everett did the LA version and the LA perspective. And we went back and forth, and we were having like an argument about which city is better and which approach is better. And I think this gives us like the fantastic ability, because Neil's a West Coast guy, very laid back. I'm a Philly, you know, through and through, in the sense of intense, you know, passionate about my teams, live and die on results. So you can get that perspective, and we have the back and forth, and never once was that, hey, don't do that story. It was more like, yeah, this is a great idea. This is a little bit outside what we normally do. Let's do it. You know, I love those type of opportunities. And, you know, when we're on a story, like my great co-host, L Duncan, is super creative. And she and I can go back and forth on anything. We've done that. Like when the Hawks, her Hawks beat my Sixers, she got a Hawks player to basically tape something, and they played it on the air, and they gave me a red velvet cupcake to eat as the sore loser of the game, you know, of the series. And to me, that's the great stuff that we could do when it comes to being creative. You're still reporting on the story. You're still getting to the bottom of why this is a big deal or what's the headlines today. But at the same time, you can have fun with it. Mm-hmm. And our shows are, you know, the producers I've worked with through the years, whether it's the morning show when I work with Hannah, or you know, the other morning show when I was with Jay Harris and Randy Scott and Serena Morales, you know, and Jamie Sire, like, we were given the creativity. Let's think out the box. What do we want to do? And now with L. Duncan on the 6 p.m., it's been great because we could just be authentic and be ourselves and have the ability to be creative. And, hey, I want to stand up here. I want this in the background. And I want to explain this story before we get to the soundbite. Mm-hmm. And the directors, you know, Chris Scott and Justin Daly, our producer, and Manny De La Fay, our coordinating producer, they're always like, give me more. We want more of this. We love this kind of stuff, this type of energy, because it separates us from, you know, some of the standard stuff that people are watching. So that's what I love about it. And every single day, it's a different way to express yourself, and it's a different way to headline all the topics in sports.
That's fascinating. I mean, so each show, I mean, you're prepping for how many hours?
So we have a new 6 p.m. show for me. We have a noon show meeting, mm-hmm. and we go through all the headlines and stories and what we want to talk about. And then we come in a little bit later on. By that time, the producer will actually put together a rundown with all of our suggestions. And, you know, research will weigh in. We've got, you know, production assistants, associate producers, segment producers all weighing in on topics that we could discuss that they think is worth it. And then it's the producer who puts together a rundown, usually a 60-minute show. And he takes a bunch of stuff. Then he finds out who are the analysts. We reach out to them, find out what they want to talk about.
Wow.
And we collaborate for 3 hours, and then we go on the air.
That's crazy. And so the last 3 hours, you're basically kind of writing it?
Yes.
That is fascinating. Does it ever get kind of stressful, or do you ever feel kind of, I mean, you're doing it every day. Is it just kind of normal now, or, you know what I mean? Or is there a little bit of pressure, still each time?
It's normal, but yeah, I tell anybody, if you ever go into a show and you're just not nervous, then you're not really caring about the show. Like mm-hmm. It's positive nerves. It's nerves that you can control, that they're not taking over, because those nerves are, you want to do a great job and you're excited about the job, right? Same thing, I think, with actors, same thing with comedians. Like you're nervous about something because you want to perform well, but it's nerves that you control. I you know, athletes have the same type of nerves before a game, right? It's mm-hmm. you control those nerves, and then you rely on your instincts and you trust what you wrote. You trust what you've practiced. And I tell my, you know, 9-year-old now, you know, when he gets ready for games, he'll tell me I'm nervous. And I'm like, I'm happy you're nervous. Like, that's a great thing, because you care and you want to succeed. It's now, how do we handle those nerves, and how do we approach them and say, okay, that's a good thing, because I'm going to perform well. And so I think when you go into a show and you've got nerves, it's not nerves that are taking over and shutting you down. It's nerves saying, I'm excited. Let's go. I feel good about today.
Yeah. That's awesome. And it's a huge teamwork.
Totally.
So you got a lot of people there to kind of rely on and help out and pitch in. And
Brian, the best way I can explain it to any sports fan when they watch our show, Tom Brady, win or lose, will get the most credit and the most criticism, right?
Yeah.
But in reality, you're relying on the offensive coordinator, the head coach calling the right plays. You're relying on your offensive lineman to block. You're relying on your wide receivers to get open. You're relying on your running back to find the hole. You're relying on the center to snap. And in the end, no one's talking about anybody else but the quarterback. We are the same way. In the end, you don't see all the people that we're relying on, whether it's the director, technical director, whether it's the audio person, whether it's our producer, a segment producer, associate producer, the person that's editing, whether it's the camera guys, you know, the stage manager. There are so many things going on, and then it all comes into one, and then we deliver. It's like a game plan for a football game.
Mm, yeah, that's fascinating. How do you guys stay on top of all the sports? I mean, because you're covering so many different things. I mean, are you just constantly just looking at the sports page? Not the sports, you know what I mean? Just the scores, how people are doing. I mean, just...
We have so many people. Like, we have news editors that are behind the scenes that are not on the air, but they're monitoring social media. They'll get an email if Woj wants to break a story, or Schefter just got this story in. They'll communicate that to our coordinating producer and our producer, and then they're like, "All right, let's get them on. Do we have a camera set up? You know, let's go." Like, all of that is going behind the scenes. Or there's times in commercial break and Elle and I will be on Twitter and be like, oh, did you guys just see that tweet that just came out from such and such? And the producer will like, we'll take a look at it. And then that producer will send that tweet to our graphics guy and our researcher. They'll build something. And so we can pop something on, or they'll say, hey, all right, we're going to deal with this breaking news that just got confirmed by our news desk. Let's go. Mm-hmm. And boom, you're on the air with it.
Mm. Wow. Give me a couple of names of people living or dead who you'd love to have a chat with or interview sometime. For you, I haven't had a chance.
Sports related, right?
Sure. Anything.
That I would love to interview. That is,
or just have a chat with, have dinner with.
Have dinner with. I'd love to have dinner with former President Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. Just to hear his perspective on what it was like with the most pressure on a daily basis to where it is now, and post life, and post, you know, presidency in the White House, and how do you manage? I find that fascinating. Some of the best stories, Brian, with our job too, was when you're in the green room before show and you sit down with some guys. You know, I've done this many times where I've sat down with guys and I've said, okay, so what exactly happened on this play, you know, in this game? And then they'll give you the real story. And you're like, oh, that happened. Or you're hearing them go back and forth on a you know, situation that they were in when you potentially may have teammates and stuff. I find that stuff fascinating.
Yeah.
I find Nick Saban fascinating. I find Bill Belichick fascinating. Guys that are so successful. And then you hear stories. And Nick and I have talked a handful of times behind the scenes, and he likes to share stories and make you laugh. And, you know, so what you see on camera is completely different from what you experience behind the scenes.
Yeah.
You know, I can keep on going. I'd love to. I think talking to somebody like Candace Parker would be amazing. Mm-hmm. Diana Taurasi, because they've achieved so much success in a sport that this country loves, but the WNBA is not on the same level of the NBA, which I find that curious that they have to go to Europe to make, you know, to make ends meet, where they're like stars, like superstars.
Right. Yeah.
And I love how that has changed now in the last couple of years, where, you know, many of these guys are, and girls, I should say, or women are getting their own brands and their own sneakers, well-deserved, and how it's changed over the years and what they've had to deal with. To me, it's breaking through walls, and you're the first at something. I want to know what it was like and what helped them while they experienced it, because I relate that stuff to my experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was this like? What did you go through? You know, when you dealt with adversity, how did you handle it? How do you keep going and continuing to kind of remake yourself to be better? Because the biggest challenge is not actually climbing to the top, it's staying at the top, right?
Yeah.
you know, when I came to ESPN and people were like, oh, what's it like? And I've told them many times, I'm like, it's like climbing Mount Everest. Now, I've never done that, but like, I imagine the feeling of climbing Mount Everest. And then you look around and you're like, all right, what's next? And how do I stay here? Because your whole goal is to get there, but really the challenge is staying there. And we've seen that in sports teams. Their goal is to win a championship, but the real tough part is coming back the next year and maintaining and being the defending champ. So everybody wants to take you down.
That to me is the
biggest thing that I'd love to pick the brains of people that experience that. What's it like to go through it again? How do you handle that? You know, obviously the Michael Jordans of the world, you'd love to sit down and say, six times you did it and two three-peats. What was the key? You know, I'd be curious about those conversations.
Sure. Well, you've obviously done a really good job of staying at the top. I mean, you know, you're incredibly good at what you do. And I think your outlook and your personality and your ethics also play a part. But
Brian, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. You know, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough, Kevin. This has been fascinating for me and a real pleasure. And everybody just go watch SportsCenter, see what Kevin's doing. I mean, he's one of the best in the business and a fantastic person to boot. So
Thank you.
Brian, thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate that. I had a heck of a lot of fun here. And for everybody that's listening, I hope you have a safe and healthy 2022.
Thank you for listening to The Creative Spark. To learn more about host G. Brian Benson, his latest best-selling book, Habits for Success, and this week's amazing guest, please visit the show notes. And we love building community, making new friends, and spreading the goodness. So don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends and family. Till next time, as Brian always says, be well, be creative, and always be yourself.